Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the 81st episode of the Dapper Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan. With me, as always, we have Joe.
Sup?
Mean Muggin' Joe, that's his name. And we have with us Game Dave.
Hey there.
I guess I didn't know what channel to say you're a part of, so I said Re-Rez.
Recently.
Yeah, that's kind of a recent thing. Why don't you tell the people what you do?
Well, I do videos about video games. Makes sense that I would be on the Dapper Gaming Podcast then. Reviews, some humorous stuff, a lot of retro kind of focus, and recently joined up with Shane Lewis, Corey and Tri of My Life in Gaming, and John from the 8-Bit Duke to kind of bring more content to the Re-Rez channel, since we all kind of have a sort of a similar scope about, you know, gaming and its importance for online video and things like that. So that's where we are now. So.
Yeah, actually, I've been really liking the content that's coming out, like, not just from Shane, but everyone else on that channel. I don't think John or Duke has done anything yet, but
not yet. He's got some big plans though, some cool stuff.
But it reminds me of, like, the structure of that channel now kind of reminds me of Geek and Sundry, but more about video games.
Right.
Like, it's more focused on one smaller aspect, where Geek and Sundry is, like, huge now.
Yeah.
But, like, the production value of the Re-Rez stuff is just so much higher than really what anyone else is doing, except for maybe Geek and Sundry.
Well, I think that's what brought us together, because we all knew each other, and definitely we all have a video production background. So I think that kind of shows through in a lot of our content. I think that's why he made that decision. So
are there any kind of, like, future plans that you can tell people about, or is that all pretty quiet right now?
There are, well, at this point, our real goal was, again, that we all make high quality production content for the most part, not to blow smoke up our butts, but, you know, we care a lot about the production value of our content. We all love gaming, even bad stuff in gaming. We still appreciate it. And I think, you know, we try to be positive, even if I'm angry about something, or even if the other guys are angry about something in a game, we still try to, you know, find the positives in that, which, of course, as you know, Shane, with positives and negatives, that's kind of a big deal to him. And initially, we really just want to be able to bring as much content to people as often as we can, because the problem with video producers, specifically with gaming, the guys who do really intense stuff, their output is very slow. Yeah.
Like, and I think another, like, a person who's kind of a perfect example of that would be Errant Signal. He does, like, these game analyses, like these really in-depth ones. He does, like, one a month, so he has to, like, do Patreon, because there's no way that, like, YouTube would work out for you, since anyone who makes any amount of money on YouTube is at least once a week, and anyone who's making real money is twice a day. So it's like,
exactly,
how do you produce that?
Yeah, and I think the idea was, because any of us, if we try to do YouTube full time and focus on our gaming content full time, one, we'd be broke. Two, we would burn ourselves out, because, you know, it's just a different kind of production, especially a lot of the stuff that Shane works on, a lot of the stuff that Corey and Tri do. Those are some heavy, intense videos that, you know, they don't just turn around in a day. And to be able to produce that kind of content weekly on our personal channels, it's near impossible, especially the fact that most of us aren't doing this full time yet. That would be a nice thing to do. We certainly are pushing to be able to do that in the future, but right now we're not there yet. But coming together as a team, and we all understand, you know, high quality production and things like that, we're able to put out content every week now, and kind of have, like, this rotation in this schedule, as, you know, as the community that's already on ReRes gets to know us as a team, you know, obviously we all have different styles. We're bringing different things to the table. And I think it'll take time to still get used to that and grow the community even more. But just being able to provide, you know, entertainment and content regularly, I think is going to make a huge difference.
Yeah, I think that should probably help with that channel a lot. Plus, it's not like the people who are on there now are making content that's like too vastly different in tone from what Shane was doing anyways.
Right.
So, like, it's not like all of a sudden there's it. ReRes is also a Let's Play channel.
Yeah, yeah, and that was one of the first things when we had our meeting, when we kind of talked about the idea of, you know, let's make this work for everybody. Let's become a team to where we, you know, we're each pushing each other to do better stuff and, you know, just becoming a team. And that was one of the first things Shane says, like, my number one rule is we don't do Let's Plays. And I was like, yeah, that's totally fine. Because if we did that, then... And not that I'm saying that there's anything wrong with Let's Plays, but when it comes to a channel like ReRes and a group like ReRes, that's not what people come there for. And if we suddenly start doing these, even if we did them as a group Let's Plays, it's going to change the dynamics of the channel. And none of us are really Let's Players. We've talked about maybe doing some ReRes team streams in the future. That's probably where anything Let's Play-ish would happen.
Yeah, especially because, like, the issue with Let's Plays, they're harder than you think. Like, it's not so much a, like, you can do good video production. It's, are you good at riffing? Like, the people who are good at that are good riffers. And it's not like a, they can sit down and make fun of a game kind of thing. It's like, they have to be kind of, like, at the same level as, like, Mystery Science Theater or, like, something like that. Like, it's kind of a comedy background more than a video production background or like a script writing background. Cause like not anyone can sit down and write a script, but just like they're different skill sets. So.
Oh yeah. 100%. Because I mean, and there are some people who I've seen that have like, they'll shoot their gameplay footage and then they'll go back and they'll script to it. And then they'll record their audio after the fact. And it still doesn't feel right. Like, you can still tell that it's not, like, a live commentary. It's not real reactions. And, yeah.
It depends on the game. There's some like that. Like, there's some post, like, commentary Let's Plays that I really liked. I think Diabetes, he was on, like, the Something Awful forums. He does a lot of stuff with Slow Beef. They do Retsu Prey. They're, like, a channel that makes fun of really bad Let's Plays on YouTube.
Gotcha.
But he did a Let's Play of, like... Super Mario Galaxy 2, and like that was post commentary because, to be honest, how do you do it live, like with a good mic, because you're moving your arms around like an idiot, because
that'd be tough.
So that's a tough game to like do live because you can't sit in front of a computer. So
yeah, it's a different skill set entirely to do Let's Plays, especially live Let's Plays, and to do them well, because you have to be as interesting as the game for it to work.
Yeah, if not more, because if the game turns out to be bad,
you're in trouble. You're as bad as the game.
Yeah, I mean, like, the good Let's Players are, like, also good podcasters, I guess. Not necessarily, like, video game podcasters, but, like, comedy podcasters. Like,
right.
You see some of those people kind of cross over some of that skill, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I guess... Unless you have more to talk about the ReRes channel, what have you been playing this week, or at least as of recent?
Well, I recently, I'm a big Suikoden fan, and obviously I was all over the news about Suikoden 2 being released to PSN finally, much deserved. So I recently went through and replayed the original Suikoden. I just finished that up in preparation to replay through Suikoden 2, so I've been doing a lot of that. Been playing a lot of weird import games lately, similar to the Urusei Yatsura review that I did, my first video on ReRes. I really want to look at a lot more import games, so I've been kind of going through my back catalog of import games, just because it's so interesting to play these games that did not make it here, and there's still so many that people haven't talked about, and I think that's something important to...
And there's still games, like, coming out now that don't make it here.
Exactly.
And like, we'll never make it here. Like Puyo Puyo Tetris. I know Giant Bomb got behind that in a big way, in some, like, in a way that that game has kind of been become like a cult hit in North America, even though it'll never release here, just because I think Ubisoft owns the rights to Tetris.
Mm.
So it will just never come out here. But it's like this weird, like, Puyo Puyo, like, Tetris mashup game that makes no sense. And weird. You play as, like, a fish man.
That sounds awesome to me. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. It's apparently the best Tetris game ever made, and it's like an Xbox One game that is only out in Japan.
Wow.
In a country that doesn't
it's crazy.
Buy Xboxes.
Yeah, that's super weird.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a big deal. So yeah, that's what I've been playing a lot of. Yeah, Suikoden, a lot of import games, and also a lot of games for some future reviews that I've got coming out on both ReRez and my personal Game Dave channel.
So when you play import games, like, do you look for like fan translations, or do you speak Japanese, or?
I do not speak Japanese. I can read some. I did take a course in Japanese, but one semester of Japanese is not enough to speak any Japanese. That's what I learned, at least for me. But I normally I will try to find a fan translation. I do have the Retron 5, which does offer the ability to load those fan translations now, which is nice. So you can still feel like you're playing it on the hardware, even though it's obviously not, because it's just an emulation box. But I think that's one of the features that makes me still appreciate the Retron 5, to be able to do those fan translations from the cartridges. I think that's pretty neat. And if I can't do that, then I just stumble my butt right through it.
Yeah, and in some of those old games, it kind of makes it pretty impossible.
Yeah, and luckily...
old games have this thing where, like... Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Urusei Yatsura was definitely one of the easier to play, because most of the content's in English. Most of the platformers in English or platforming and action games, generally you don't really need, you know, much of a knowledge of Japanese. Like another one I've been playing in preparation, hopefully to review, we'll see how it turns out, but Dragon Buster. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, about that series.
No, I'm not.
But, yeah, there was Dragon Buster 1 and 2, which were for the original Famicom. The original one was a port of the arcade game, and then the third one was for the PlayStation that did make it stateside and into North America, and that was Dragon Valor for the original PlayStation, which is kind of a remake sequel to the first two games. But that one also, you don't need really a knowledge of Japanese to play that, and it's kind of like, it's very Zelda 2, but it's a little bit before Zelda 2 that it made it out. So
well, I'm looking forward to, like, seeing that, I guess. Like, the import games are always interesting because not only do they usually have, like, just these crazy stories that don't make any sense. Like, they never come out here as those games normally because they, like, just wouldn't be any kind of, like, cultural relevance here. And I can't remember what game it was that I think it was a NES game, and it was like about dragons. It's like a fantasy game, but here it was about two wrestlers from like the WWE, just because coincidentally the two characters like shared the same name as two wrestlers in the WWE.
Let's make them wrestlers. Nailed yep. it.
Which doesn't make any sense because like fantasy RPG, but it just happens to have like the names of these two WWE wrestlers. So that's their marketing. Like when it finally comes over.
This will localize perfectly.
Yeah, it totally makes sense.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. There are so many crazy Japanese RPGs, especially for the Famicom and some for the Super Famicom, that never came here. Some of them I've been trying to look for some good fan translations of. There's actually one that I'm looking at, and from what I understand, my limited Japanese knowledge, but apparently you are a man who wakes up with amnesia. And for some reason, the world has been taken over by women, and women now rule over all men, and you're trying to find out why, and this is a turn-based RPG game. So I was like, that, I have to talk about that, because that's awesome. How weird is that?
Yeah, that is, they're really strange. I mean, like, Japan just had weird games. I think they still do, but
Yeah, I feel like they take more risks, at least with their stories, maybe.
Yeah, well, maybe like they used to. I mean, they used to take all kinds of risks. Like, look at Nintendo in the 80s, early 90s with the Famicom and the Super Famicom. Like, with the Famicom, the was it the Super Famicom disc system? Is that what it was?
The original Famicom. Yeah, the disc system.
Yeah, so the disc system had an Ethernet port on it and online banking.
Oh, so, or is it, are we talking about the Satellaview?
I don't think it was that. I think it was a Famicom add-on.
Okay, you, so that, like, yeah, I know there was the disc system, which used floppy disks, for which is how Zelda 2 was originally released and how the real Super Mario Brothers 2 was released.
But, yeah, one of the Famicom systems for, that was, like, Japan only, had a, like, online service that you could do online banking with. Like, that doesn't make any sense in the late 80s. Online
banking. I could drive to the bank, or let me get, you know, let me get the Famicom booted up.
Yeah.
Let me go through some menus.
Which is just bizarre. But they also had that reprintable cartridge, right? So you could like go and print your own cartridges at like these crazy machines that were in like corner stores. While they were in like convenience stores, like 7-Elevens in Japan,
right.
And you would put
right.
like this cartridge in and like write a game to it.
Yeah, because usually the I have a couple disc system games. There's actually a series of them that I also want to talk about. That's the problem when you do online reviews. There's like just too many games you want to talk about. That's never going to happen. But I have been starting to learn more about the disc system, and it is so cool that a lot of the games, there would be, from what I understand, I could be wrong, but there were blue floppy disc games for the disc system, and those were ones that were copy protected. They couldn't be overwritten. And then I believe most of or some of the yellow floppy disks could have certain sides written. So if you bought Super Mario Brothers 2, you could get Super Mario Brothers 1 written on side B of the floppy disk. So you would occasionally have to switch sides and things. So that's kind of neat. You could get two games in one disk, and they would even release them sometimes. But then there's the fear of it's just scary to think that some games, like, people just would totally write over their game just to try another game. Like, that's crazy to me.
Yeah, but this thing that I'm talking about is like a rewritable cartridge. Like, is it a cartridge? It's not a disc.
Right. Well, that's even
that you would like take to a machine and put the cartridge in this machine at like a 7-Eleven, and it would write, and you would like put money in, and it would write a game to the cartridge, and then you would like take it home, go play it, come back with your cartridge later, write a new game to it.
I wonder how much that was.
No clue, but it's like an orange little cartridge, like. It's like a cassette size, really. Like, it's the same size as a Famicom cartridge. And it has, like, these little toggles on it, on the front. And, yeah, it was rewritable, and it has Mario on the front, like this, like, doing a peace sign. And, yeah, it's, like, the size of a cassette tape. Like, it's not very big. I think you can find it if you search, like, rewritable Famicom cartridge. But in Japan, they had, like, an actual cartridge that was used with a Famicom that was rewritable. So like that, you didn't rent games, you like temporarily wrote them to a cartridge.
That is pretty sweet. Yeah, I'm gonna have to look into that. That's cool.
Yeah, like the things that were going on with the Famicom in Japan were like super ahead of their time. Like
Yeah.
So Joe, what have you been playing this week?
Pretty much only two games, because I've been
working.
I've put in probably about 50 to 60 hours in work in the past week, so it's been crazy for me. But I have found enough time to play a little bit, play the Hat in Time beta. I've pretty much beat that, collected everything. That game is looking to be amazing when the full release comes out. It still has a long way to go to be anything outstanding, but it's definitely, from the beta, it's something that I'm looking forward to.
Is it like mechanically good, but just content like is lackluster at this point, or?
Yeah, it's mechanically good. It looks amazing. The music's outstanding. Everything about it's really good. It's just obviously it's a beta, so there's not much on the content side right now. But when the full game comes out, I'm expecting a lot. So far in the beta, you can only get like 14 hourglasses, I think, and then there's two doors. Because there's a main hub and there's two doors that to unlock them you need 20 hour glasses and 50 hour glasses. So there's going to be a lot more of them to collect. So there's going to be a lot to collect in that game. Hopefully it's not too much, because then it might suffer from the same thing Donkey Kong 64 suffered from. But I think they know what they're doing. I think the game's going to turn out to be very good.
I'm hoping so, because I want kind of more platformers like that.
Yeah.
Because there's not really any, like, no one really does 3D platformers like that. I think it might be understandable why they weren't particularly great. Like, the issue is mechanics issue. Like, 3D platforming is hard to do and not do it, like, slow. And so you kind of get, like, it's this weird issue with design where you're trying to get your pacing of the game correct, but you can't really do it if the character is, like, you can't platform well if the character moves too quickly, but you can't pace the game well if the character moves slow. Like, because if you think back, all of the 3D platformers, like, Crash Bandicoot, you're kind of slow. Spyro, you're pretty slow, except for, like, that straight line dash. Same thing in Donkey Kong, same thing in Banjo-Kazooie, like, except for when you're going in a straight line using some kind of a dashing ability, you're pretty slow.
And Glover.
And Glover. And it's just because, like, you don't really have a choice, though, from, like, a control standpoint. If the character moves too quick, they become kind of imprecise because of working in 3D.
It's nice because in Hat in Time, there's you have your, like, jump kind of, you can dive forward, and it's what speedrunners have been using to, like, get to places very quickly. But there's also an item that allows you to equip, and basically it's running shoes, and it allows you to run wherever you want. You just hold a button and you run in any direction that you want. So it really speeds things up. And then when it comes to platforming, you just stop running and you jump and land where you want to land. There's also, like, a little umbrella to help you, like, land on smaller platforms, and there's a lot of things that have been put in to make the platforming really nice. There are some occasions where I'm like, yeah, that platform's a little too small and getting on it is kind of ridiculous. But hopefully in the full version, a lot of that will be fleshed out and it'll feel really good.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that game is coming together. Especially since that's a Kickstarter game and a lot of the Kickstarter stuff, like, hasn't come together.
I'm really glad this one is, because I think I paid a good amount of money to get in the alpha and the beta, but it was definitely worth it. Basically, I paid what you would for a full-price game, like a full-price AAA game for it. So when it comes out, I get the game, and then I got beta and alpha access. So I'd say it was definitely worth, like, what, the $60 I paid for it. If the full version doesn't come out, then it was $60 completely blown. But if the full version does come out and it's really good, then I'd be happy with the $60 I put into it. Besides that, I've only been playing one more game because I've decided to review it, and someone convinced me to pick it up, which was Dragon Ball Z Xenoverse. And that game, as a Dragon Ball Z fan, is outstanding. Probably one of the best Dragon Ball Z games that has been released in a long time. It changes things up enough just to make it new, and being able to create your own character is really fun. Just walking around, like, the main hub world, seeing all the ridiculous things that people make and their usernames and all that kind of stuff, it's really funny.
I haven't played that game yet, but I don't know a lot about that game, but someone explained it to me, like, literally an hour ago, so it's kind of relevant. That game is like a fighting game with a lot of RPG elements, because by the time that this person explained, like, the story and, like, that you have gear that you equip and that you need to, like, keep allies alive and stuff, I was like, wait, so is this, like, a Dynasty Warriors game with Dragon Ball, or, like, explain this game. Is it like Budokai, or
it's, have you ever played any of the old Dragon Ball Z games, or at least seen them?
I played the Budokai games.
It plays a lot like Budokai Tenkaichi, so it's not like you're on a plane, like, kind of in a set, like, Street Fighter style, like Budokai was. Budokai Tenkaichi, you can, there's like a giant map and you walk onto your enemy and fly around. It plays exactly like that, except now you can create your own character. As you beat story missions and side missions, you gain experience, which you can use to level up your character, and you unlock equipment and abilities that you can equip to that character. So you can change your equipment, which changes specific stats on your characters. You can give them different abilities, like turning Super Saiyan, or different special or ultimate attacks, different guards or abilities to paralyze enemies. So you can really customize your character. Plus, there's a lot of, like, there's five different races. Yeah, five different races, with three of them have male and female characteristics, and each of those races has their own different, like, the Majin Buu race is, it has, like, higher defense, and the Super Saiyans have low health, but they're really strong, and then the females and the males have their own separate stat abilities, so there's a lot of, like, variation in it, which is really cool. So each character is definitely a lot different than every other character. Really the only problem I have with that game is it's not fluent when it comes to item management, and like, because everything's done in this one big hub world, so it's like if you want to go do a side mission, you spawn in the beginning of the world, and then you got to walk all the way to the side mission area and then start up your side mission. Or if you want to do the story mission, you have to like walk through a loading screen and then through another loading screen and then go to the story mission area and then start that up. And if you want to go buy an item, then you got to go to the other direction and go through a loading screen. And then that's the, like, the item area where you can buy your items and your weapons and your power-ups and all that. So it's like,
all right. And you're like literally a person like walking in a world into like a building, right?
Yeah. Like, it's kind of like, it's kind of Destiny-ish, where you got your main hub world where you walk into different sections. And then if you want to go to a space mission, you fly into space and then you go to that space mission, except it's all contained in one little hub world with a few loading screens.
Sounds a little Monster Hunter-ish too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's really good. I'm enjoying it. It plays well. There's a lot of characters already in the game. Not as much as was in like the last couple Budokai Tenkaichi games. Pretty sure those games had like up to like 50 characters. It was ridiculous. This one kept it a little bit lower with about, I think there's about maybe 20, 25 characters right now. There's a few more coming out in DLCs though, so they're probably gonna rack on the DLCs for this game. I wouldn't be surprised. I know there's already three planned and there's a season pass, so. But great game nonetheless. Sadly, it's gone up in price. When I got it. I got the day one edition, so I got the like pre-order bonuses with it and all that. I paid $59.99 for it, and I guess GameStop just bumped the price of it up to $75. So,
well, GameStop's right, great. Then. Get it online.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm glad I got it when I did.
Like, I don't have a 360. Like, I only have an Xbox One. So, yeah. Like, the online purchasing on that is actually really smooth. And you have a lot of disk space. So, like, it doesn't make sense to do it physical.
I'd regret getting it for a 360. Mostly, I have no other option to get it for. Like, I could have gotten it for PC, but I doubt it could have ran on my PC. But the issue is 360, obviously. 360 and PS3, it runs a little bit worse than the next-gen consoles. Like, when you're in the hub world, it takes a while for other people's characters to load. And
so there's, like, a lot of reason, pop in.
Yeah. And, but with the Xbox One, the PS4, and PC, they don't have that issue at all. And for some reason, the 360 version is the only version out of all five that you can't get a season pass for. If you want to buy a season pass for the 3 DLC coming out, the 360 doesn't have that option for some reason.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. So.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they don't know if they're going to do all of it for that.
Weird though, because the PS3, you can get the season pass for PS3, PS4, PC, Xbox One, but 360 is just like the only one that doesn't have that option.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they just don't know if they're gonna release all the DLC there yet.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they can't really sell the season pass if they don't know if they're gonna like release all the DLC. And I mean, there's games that have had issues releasing DLC. Like Skyrim on the PS3. The PS3 never actually got all of the Skyrim DLC because they couldn't get the last piece to run. So
yeah. But yeah, I'm pretty sure that's all I've been playing. I wasn't on the podcast the week before, but pretty much that whole week I was playing Rogue Galaxy for the PS2. Getting farther into that, been 100%ing that game. And that game is an amazing RPG. Definitely one of my favorites. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. I haven't actually really played many games. I've been really busy. I'm trying to find a publisher for my mobile game. So, because it's really expensive to market things. I need to buy a couple ads. They're like $7,500 a piece, and I'm like, yeah, I don't have that money. Yeah, I was like talking to Rooster Teeth. I was like, how much is it to advertise with you? Like $7,500 an ad. I was like, never mind, I'll come back later.
Wow.
I will not waste your time. Like any major podcast that is on video games, like even the Giant Bombcast, which is like 300,000 downloads a week, not the like million that the Rooster Teeth podcast is $7,500. Like that's what major podcasts charge. But it's super effective marketing. Like, it just doesn't, like, traditional web marketing is really garbage. It has, like, a really poor click-through rate. So, like, I don't want to go that route where I buy, like, $500 in YouTube ads and get nothing out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, just looking for a publisher. I sent out emails today. That was the fun that I've had the last couple of weeks. I emailed Chillingo. They're an EA subsidiary. They do mobile games.
Huh.
And I guess besides that, I've been working on another mobile game. I came up with a name for it. So the last few weeks, I've been working on a like Kirby Tilt and Tumble clone. Like you roll around a person who's in a ball, and you can like roll them into these like cannons, and then shoot the can. Like shoot yourself out of the cannon, and then it's basically a platformer where you're a ball and you control it by tilting your phone like in various directions.
Huh.
Because no one's really like, the only game that I can think of that is like that is Kirby Tilt and Tumble for the Game Boy Color. I don't think anyone else has built that mechanic into like a full platformer. I think there were a few games like when the iPhone first came out that were like that, but they just had that like roll yourself to the like end of this like map thing rather than like building like platformer levels. So I'm building this game called Rad Rollers where it, think like Nickelodeon 90s kids game shows, like 80s and 90s game shows, like that's kind of like the theme, like aesthetic that we're going for, but like low poly count also. So
that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I'm working on like shader stuff, which is hard to program because there's not particularly good references on how to learn shaders. Shaders are like the piece of code that you attach to an object that determine how its light, like how it reacts with light in the game scene. So how it casts shadows, how light when it hits it like colors the object.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not particularly easy to write because there's just like no debugging tools. So it's just like, there's an error. Do you know where the error is? No, there's just an error. It's like, but thanks. I'll try to fix that next time around. So like, you don't really know what's wrong. It's just like, I'm not going to work for you.
Wow.
Like, will not start. It's like, thanks.
It's definitely a cool idea. I like the idea of, it almost sounds like, yeah, Kirby Tilt and Tumble mixed with Donkey Kong barrel shooters.
Well, like Kirby Tilt and Tumble had that mechanic where like you roll into these cannons and there's like an arrow that kind of like spins around the cannon, and then when you pressed A, you would like shoot out of the cannon. And in this case, like you're rolling around on your phone and then like you roll into the cannon and then you touch the like you tap like a button that we're gonna put on the touchscreen, and it'll like shoot you out of the cannon. So
cool.
And like onto these like moving platforms, and you try to like balance yourself on the platform, and you can jump by like flicking your phone up. So like when you're rolling down, like you'll be rolling down a hill, and like there'll be a gap, and you flick your phone up, and it'll jump you over the gap.
Oh, okay.
Like it's a fuller platformer game that's just controlled by tilting. So, and like I'm mostly doing mobile stuff, trying to like build a portfolio because I graduate pretty soon, and in the game industry, you either spend 15 years like working AAA so that you can like get a game design position, or you go out and you make games yourself and apply for game design positions. So building up a portfolio before I go to like find game design positions at actual studios is pretty important, because no one hires game designers like externally. They only hire them internally, basically, and they only really hire them if they have like 5+ years. So
gotcha.
But yeah, so I'm working on that right now. But for actual games that I've played, I played City Skylines. That came out at the beginning of the week.
It's yeah, a I keep lot... hearing that's pretty, yeah, pretty great.
Yeah, it is. It's the Sim City that we all wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have disasters and stuff, which isn't really an issue for me because I never really used them. Like, I liked just building a city that actually ran. I never found much enjoyment in destroying the city.
Yeah.
But you have all your mechanics there that you were looking for. You can build train tracks, like proper highways. You can build subways, bus routes, like all of that good stuff. Plus the water system is there. Like, you have to build your sewer. If you pump water downstream from your sewer outlet, then you poison your whole town and kill everyone. So
ooh.
Yeah, because you can like pump your sewage directly into like the river, and if you happen to pump your water out to like, if you pump your water supply like downstream from where you pump out your sewage, everyone gets everyone gets poisoned.
poo water.
Yeah, yum. Mm. And also, I spent like 6 hours building this city, and I finally got to the point where I unlocked the dam. So I built a dam, but the river was too powerful, and it overflowed the sides of the river because of the dam, and flooded my whole city, and I just had to build a new city because I turned my old one into a lake.
Wow. So I guess that's one disaster that does exist.
Yeah, is that you could build a dam and just flood the whole map.
I've also heard that the traffic can become a huge problem.
Yeah, they've talked about actually patching the traffic because they noted that it is not particularly well simulated. What is really hard, basically, is trying to get it so that when you go off of the highway, wherever that isn't just jammed, because it's always jammed.
Yeah, that's what I was hearing. Yeah, that the traffic gets jammed really easily, and but that, which is ironic, because before this release, wasn't that their focus was like transit games?
Yeah, the team that built this built a transportation simulator, or what was it called? Transport Tycoon, I think.
Yeah, something I knew it was something like that. Which, so it's kind of ironic that the traffic is a bit messed up.
Yeah, it's strange that the traffic is messed up, but the only part where I notice that the traffic is actually messed up is where you're going from the highway that comes like into the city.
Okay.
Onto whatever road you're attaching that to. My issues that I've had with that is that you just always have high traffic there. It's kind of hard to attach a road. Like, so your highway is built out of two like highway segments, and they act as one-way roads. And you have to attach that to something, right? Like to an actual road. Because you can't like build buildings alongside the highway. You don't do that in the real world, so it doesn't make sense to do it here either. Because it's a highway people don't turn off the highway, but it's just hard to attach that to a road and then not have that instantly become like the worst intersection.
Wow.
Either than that, I mean, the game's really good. Like, it performs really well. You can build huge maps. Like, the first segment of land that you're given that you start with is basically the size of the map in, like, the new SimCity, the one that came out. I guess it's been, like, 2 years since that came out. But you start with a plot of land, and it's about that size. But you can buy 8 more of those plots. So you can build, a huge city.
Yeah.
Once you've filled that out. So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a good game. If you're into city builders, like, that is the one that's worth looking into.
And it's not a full retail price either, is it?
No, it's not. I think it was like $35 or something like that.
Wow, yeah, that's
my prices are in Canadian, so they're a little higher. Cause Steam decided to put in Canadian pricing now. Like, this is like the last 6 months, so now all the games on Steam are a little more expensive. A little disappointing, but whatever.
Yeah.
It's because the Canadian dollar started to do poorly. We were like, for many years, basically 2008 to like 4 months ago, like on basically 1-to-1 with the US, like off by a couple of cents.
Mm-hmm.
And now the Canadian dollar is really dropping because of the whole oil thing. Like, oil going really down.
Gotcha.
And so our dollar dropped, and now everything's expensive again.
Mm.
Sucks for me.
Yeah, I get paid in American, so.
Yeah, me too, but I also owe people in American. And I owe more than I'm getting paid right now, so.
Getting paid in American? Owing in American.
Yeah. Stuff related to my game. I still owe the sound guy money. I gotta figure out how to pay that. I feel bad about that. But I don't have any money. What am I gonna do about it? I'll pay you one day, Brian. I swear. I swear you'll get paid. Alright, so I haven't really actually played any other games. Unless you guys have some games that you want to talk about, I would be down to maybe moving into some news.
Sure.
I said, let's get on the news.
All right.
I like news.
So there were two big events basically in the last like 2 weeks, I guess. PAX East was on the weekend, and before that was GDC, like the main GDC event in San Francisco. I think GDC Europe is, I think it's this week or next week. I can't remember. But GDC, plenty of news from GDC. So VR was kind of like the big thing of the show. All of the VR platforms that we know of were there. So Project Morpheus was there. That's Sony's VR. They announced a release date, kind of, first half of 2016. So that'll be coming for the PlayStation 4. And then Oculus was there. No release date yet on Oculus. And Steam VR, the HTC Vive, was also there, which I think they confirmed. They did like an event the week before GDC at like a mobile developers conference. But at GDC, they had actual game demos because the release date for that is this fall. So Steam VR is this year. Like, they have consumer models being manufactured now and games being developed now. So we'll see that out this year.
Wow. That's crazy to think that it's coming that quickly.
Yeah, it is. Because, like, so one of the things that was interesting about that, like, everyone knew that they were working on it at least a couple of years ago. Like, they were pretty open about that. Like, yeah, we're doing VR. And then Oculus became a thing. And once Oculus became a thing, like, several key hardware members from the Valve team all quit and they went to Oculus. So it's like, oh, well, I guess Steam VR is not, like, a thing anymore because, like, the people who were working on that went to Oculus. And also at the time, Valve, like, started doing a lot of work with Oculus support for, like, TF2, Half-Life 2, and, like, working with Steam in Oculus, like, making the Steam interface work in Oculus. And So it seemed like, oh, they're just going to back Oculus. I'm like, this is going to be the thing. And then they announced the HTC Vive for Steam VR. I guess it's been a couple of weeks, but since they announced that, like, the specs are better than the Oculus, and it's coming out this year. So it seems like clearly they're very competitive, seeing as they're first to market and they actually have games out, or at least games being developed, because there were quite a few demos of that. One of them was like kind of silly. It was a job simulator by Alchemy Labs. And you do a job, like you cook in VR. But there were other demos there.
The one I saw was bomb defusing. It was like a team one where someone had to read through like a manual and it described you how to defuse the bomb, while the other person had the virtual reality thing on and was defusing the bomb.
That's an Oculus.
That's an Oculus one.
Yeah, no. There were two more that were at GDC, that were games. They were not like little demos. One of them was an adventure game. I need to find the name of this damn adventure game. But it was a adventure game where it's like in first person, is controlled, like your vision is controlled with the helmet, and you like reach out with these VR controllers that they have for the Steam VR and like grab and manipulate objects like levers and stuff, to solve puzzles. So like you'll pick up an object and move it by like using the controller.
What do the controllers look at? Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
They're like Wiimotes with these like weird discs on top, like these saucers on top of them, and they can sense when you're like gripping them.
Huh.
So
I guess they didn't want to go the glove route.
Yeah, the glove would be probably expensive.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The issue. But it was pretty neat looking. I want to find the name of this thing. I can't.
It's about right.
I don't know why I can't find the damn name. I saw it yesterday on Polygon, and I just can't seem to find it now.
So an adventure game where you get grabby.
Yeah, pretty much. And then there was another one which was like a board game, but the board had things on it that you could never do in a real board game. Like, I had a dragon flying around that would like go burn down villages and stuff. And so the thing, one of the features about the Steam VR is that it has these two base stations. They're like tiny. They're like smaller than a pop can. And you put them on the ground and they do the same thing that the Kinect does. Basically it creates an infrared array by blasting out infrared light everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it works for a 15 square foot area. But it works obviously with a smaller area too. Like you put the base stations closer together and it'll just make a smaller area, and you can walk around one-to-one in that area. And so for this board game, you need a 1 meter square area, and you're standing there with the headset on and there's this board, and you like walk into the board and like look down at the board and like go into caves and stuff that are in this tabletop game, and like select units by using the controller.
Man, get like four guys who all have Oculus, who all have the VR things, and just go at it on a board game night.
Sounds crazy expensive, but crazy awesome if it was done right.
Yeah, yes. Like the board game looked really neat. You should probably look at that.
If you have a bunch of friends who all buy virtual reality, then...
Yeah, yeah. It makes sense that they would do the kind of headset combined with the Kinect kind of technology. I mean, that seems like the
It's called Sky way. World. That's the game that I was looking
Sky
for.
Sky World?
Yeah.
It seems like an easier way to do movement.
Go to SGC or something and just find a bunch of people who brought their virtual reality kit.
But
bring your VR kit?
You should look at the game demos that they have, because they're pretty neat. Like right now they're definitely just demos because they're not full-out games, but all the demos that they showed at GDC are like, these are demos of games that are coming out this fall, rather than what like Project Morpheus did, for example. Like they have demos, but it's like clearly just a tech demo, where it's like, here you are in a cage and there's a shark out there and the shark is really real looking, but it's right. not like there's no like gameplay to it. So it's like, this is for tech and tech only.
Yeah, I was surprised that Morpheus already had a 2016 planned release. I feel like that's really early for the first console specific headset. And then, but then you're saying this
Steam this, VR is Steam, this like, fall. Yeah,
this already, like, that's not that far away. But I mean,
well, to be fair, like, Valve's been working on it for a long time too. Like,
they had a headset for Oculus, is that right?
Yeah, they were doing it before Oculus. It just didn't seem like it. Valve doesn't talk about what they're doing ever. So until they're done, like, I think they only came out because people were getting like, people are getting antsy about VR, like they want it, and people are entering the space. Like, even Microsoft is kind of entering the space. They're not doing VR, but they have the HoloLens, which is like that augmented reality headset, where they showed like a Minecraft demo of that. They did it at like the Microsoft Dev Days kind of thing, but they also had it at GDC, where it's like this. It kind of looks like Google Glass. It's like this kind of transparent screen that you have in front of your eyes. And when you're looking at an object, like, you could be looking at your kitchen table and it could have like a Minecraft world on it. Like, that's the kind of demo that they showed.
Yeah, I remember seeing the when they first kind of announced the HoloLens, they showed the commercial trailer for it that teased it.
Yeah.
And it looked way better than I imagined it could have. Like, well, obviously that was all pre-rendered stuff. So I'm curious to see how it really came out.
Yeah, but like everyone's entering this space now, and so it seems like Valve is kind of like, okay, well, if we're going to enter the space, like, we think that we have a good product, we should probably talk about it now before. Right. Also, GDC seems like a reasonable place to talk about it, especially if you're going to release this year, because you want to get developers on board, right? And that's the place to do it, is like, here's this piece of tech that we're announcing, here's demos, you can all develop for it. Like, it's going to release. Whereas, like, with Oculus, one of the harder parts to talk about Oculus, like, as a dev, I wouldn't want to do Oculus-related things because I don't know when it's coming out, and then that means there's no market for whatever the hell I make. Like, you can't put budget behind an Oculus title right now because it isn't a, it's not a product. Like, there's nothing out for it. You can get the dev kits, but they're dev kits.
Right. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it works out with Sony. The fact that it's a console system, that's going to be weird.
I don't know if it's that weird. The issue that I have with it is I don't know if it's powerful enough, because the PS4 is already kind of having issues. Like, the games that were coming out at its launch were 1080p, but now the games that are coming out for it already are starting to drop down to 720p. And so we're like, have we already hit the peak of these consoles, like, within like 2 years? And if so, can you do VR? Like, because the resolution and the demands of VR are higher than the demands of like a console game, because on your TV you're sitting far enough away that resolution doesn't become too big of an issue. Like, if the resolution goes down, it's not as noticeable. But if it's on a high-res screen that is an inch away from your eyes, like, you drop the resolution of the game and you can see it, like, it becomes jaggy. Because it's not like, if they have to drop the resolution, it's not like they could use anti-aliasing. Like, they're already screwed. So
yeah, because you're like, well, yep, I see it.
Yeah, and if you're dropping the resolution to increase the frame rate, you can't anti-alias, because the anti-aliasing is harder than dropping the resolution. So, like, they're kind of just screwed on a performance standpoint, and if that's where that goes, like, they won't be able to do AAA titles, maybe. Like, they won't, you might not see Call of Duty and, like, these other big action titles support the hardware, because it just might not be able to do it. So, and that's kind of my worry with that, because the issue is, like, whatever is the first, so there's two issues. The first VR headset out is the one that sets the bar. And if it comes out, and I guess it's going to be Steam VR, if it comes out and it's bad, then the whole industry's dead. Like, VR is not going to happen this time around. But the other issue is that that not necessarily the first one, but the popular one comes out, and like, the Morpheus is kind of the one that has the most mainstream like reach, I guess, because there's just a hell of a lot more PS4s and it probably has the easiest setup.
Yeah, but, that's what I was thinking.
If that sucks, then VR is dead. So right. Hopefully they don't make something bad.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. The one that I've been working with, actually.
Hey. Just give me a second, Joe. We'll just like find a natural pause of sorts.
Yeah.
See, this one, I don't know about this. This one's pretty good. I've been working with. But yeah, it was the first one out, and it killed it.
It killed it. It was perfect. Never be better.
Never. Unbeatable.
Unbeatable. All right. Joe, why don't you give us some last thoughts on this VR stuff before you run out on me?
I feel like it's going to make 2020 the year that a bunch of children need glasses.
Sitting too close to the TV.
Yeah.
There's the quote. There's the quote on the side of the box.
Made me need glasses.
I gotta go, though. So, sorry about that, but I will see you guys later and enjoy the rest of your podcast.
Take it easy. See you later, Joe. Sorry about that little awkward pause there, but we're back. Not that you and I haven't actually been here, but...
Yeah, we didn't go anywhere.
So the VR stuff is coming quick, which is exciting, but it also, poses a lot of issues, not just related to the console stuff, but how do you design a game for VR? Some of the things that you look at, a traditional shooter like Call of Duty, you have to redesign that experience. It doesn't work on VR, right? Because your arms and your head are disconnected, and so you need an aiming system that's kind of like Arma's. In Arma, your head is disconnected from your arms, and that's a shooter, it's a first-person shooter, but you don't shoot where you're looking. And in Call of Duty, since the arms and the head are bound together, that doesn't work in VR since your camera is your head. So there's lots of interesting balance issues that also come up, So in arena shooters, for example, the pull-up time on big weapons, the huge rocket launcher, was slower than the pull-up time on the smaller guns. And that was for a balancing reason, right? You were slower with the rocket launcher than you were with whatever, the starting pistol or something from Rise of the Triad. And if the pull-up time becomes how fast you move your arms rather than something that you explicitly state in the animation, then how do you balance that? You have to get around that somehow.
Resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would get tricky. And I guess the other issue is, a lot of the some of the Kinect games, it's the whole better with Kinect. You had the option of using Kinect, or you could play it otherwise. But if it's a VR specific game, there's probably no way to really. You'd have to have two complete different versions of the game.
Yes and no. It kind of so when you're working in Unity and other game engines, you have when you're doing inputs, there's you create these kind of virtual buttons. You don't say hit the Xbox X button. You say hit button jump. You'll create a fake button called jump. And then when you want to bind to those platforms, you bind the controller button that you want to be jump to the jump button. But whenever you reference that in code, it's jump. And so it's pretty easy to switch between different types of controllers. And then in the case of for example, that Steam VR game that I mentioned, the one that is it's kind of Myst, it's a first person and adventure puzzle game, right?
Right.
They've announced that that's coming out not only on Steam VR, it'll be out on PC, but it has Steam VR support.
Okay. And
so you'll be able to play it with a traditional controller, not just with the Steam VR controllers. And not only will you be able to play it with the Steam VR headset and the Steam VR controllers, but you can play it with the Steam VR headset and keyboard and mouse, or Steam VR headset and Xbox controller, or just Xbox controller and a monitor. So it seems like a lot of those tools that you need would probably be built into the game engine, because that's kind of why you use game engines, so that they like cover that for you. Like in Unity, you can just import the Oculus library and start setting up for Oculus. Like, you have to design your mechanics around it, but the like actual code work is not too heavy.
Okay.
It doesn't get really heavy until you basically get to the optimization part, because whatever you make has to run at the frame rate of the visor. Otherwise, you get frame rate drops, which cause motion sickness in this case, rather than just looking gross. Like, you see frame rate drops on PC and Xbox, and you're like, oh, that doesn't look good. But when it happens, like, with a VR headset, it makes you want to puke. So
right. Yeah, and I know Shane from ReRes, he already had issues with the Oculus giving him motion sickness, but that's, you know, specific to him. But yeah. But apparently they've fixed a lot of those issues. Is that true?
Yeah, it was mostly latency related. The latency has gone down to at least in the case of the Morpheus, I think they said they got it down to like 3 to 5 milliseconds, which is like high performance monitor rate. And the like old dev kit for the Oculus was like 15 milliseconds, which is like a cheap monitor.
Feel a lot more natural.
Like, I worked in a VR lab for a little while when I was like starting school. Mm-hmm. And the latency is what causes the motion sickness. Like,
okay.
Even a small amount of latency, like over 10 milliseconds, will make you motion sick, like for most people. So if the old dev kit was at 15, like, I'm not surprised that Shane was really sick.
Yeah.
But if the dev kit's now, and like the Morpheus and the VR, they're getting down to like the 3 to 5 range, then that should not be so much of an issue for Shane anymore. He should be able to like actually use those.
That's good.
Yeah, like the biggest issue in VR really has been latency, like forever. Because like I said, if it's high, then your body freaks out. Like, it doesn't know what's happening, because you're moving, but you're not getting a reaction to it.
Right.
And it is like very physically upsetting. But yeah, hopefully like the implementation of the stuff is pretty easy. I know that all the Steam VR stuff is in Source 2, like Source Engine 2, which they also announced at GDC. And then when they announced Unity 5 at GDC, they said that they were including Oculus support, which wasn't previously supported with Unity 4. So it seems like the support for VR is there. It seems like we're actually making a real push. Like, the tech is here, and the software tools are here. So it's just a matter of making some like worthwhile experiences for VR. Until we have those, I don't think that there's going to be like an adoption of VR.
Right. Yeah.
So, what else was at GDC? GDC is like pretty tech heavy. Three big announcements from GDC related to game engines. So Unreal Engine 4 is free, kind of, with an asterisk. So if you make more than $3,000, you have to pay a 5% royalty, which is not really very free at all, but free. They got rid of their subscription fee. Previously, you had to pay $15 a month, I think, to use Unreal Engine 4. Now you don't, but you don't get particle systems, and you pay a 5% royalty. Unity 5 was announced and released during GDC. Unity 5 is actually, it's pretty great. I don't think that Unity gets the love that they deserve as an engine, because it's pretty powerful. But the issue that Unity has is that it's more free than Unreal. And it's been free for a long time. You only buy it if you make more than $100,000, which is really fair when the engine's $1,500. So, I mean, if you made $100,000, you should be able to afford it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no royalty, so it's not like you made $100,000, so it's $1,500 plus like another $5,000. Whereas with Unreal, like, if you make a game and it happens to be a hit, like, it's like you took on a business partner.
Yeah,
whereas if you used Unity and like you make, especially on mobile, where like your game costs you $500 to make. Like the last game I made cost $800. Our only expense was sounds, because we hired someone to professionally do sounds rather than just buy pre-built sounds at $1 a piece.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, there was no expenses. And so when you're only spending like $800 to make a game and then have to pay like a 5% royalty, like that's a lot of money if your game happens to be popular. Because like on mobile, the first game I ever made was called Grappling Gary. And that one, bad business decisions on my part. Someone who's no longer my friend kind of screwed me on that, but my game made 200 grand in like a month and a half.
Oh, wow.
And like, that's a really simple game. Like, it was very small. It took me like 2 weeks to do. And it was made on a budget of like $100. So it's like, like the turnaround on that is huge, right? And so so 5% of that is like 10 grand, and that's too much if you're like for that engine, I guess, especially when you're not using much of it. Whereas mm-hmm. at least with Unity, you just pay the $1,500. Like, that's way less than the 5%. Also, Unity is just more powerful, like, as a game engine. Unreal, because of the games that it was like that were made with it, like Gears of War, like a lot of AAA stuff, people know that Unreal is powerful, which mm-hmm. isn't really the case with Unity, because it's always been free, so it's been kind of a tool used by indie developers, but also by kind of like hobbyists. So a lot of the games with Unity are awful. Like, there's just a lot of garbage. Because, like, okay. anyone could download Unity and start making a game, right?
Right.
And as a result, there's just a lot of garbage that, like, before you launch it, says made with Unity. But there's a lot of stuff made with Unity that is really great that doesn't say made with Unity before, because you pay the $1,500 and it doesn't boot with the made by Unity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, Campo Santo, which is a... I think they're San Francisco based, but they're ex Telltale and Clay guys. Clay are the guys who did Mark of the Ninja. They're from Vancouver, and they're doing a game called Firewatch, and that's made with Unity, and that's like one of the like best looking games that I've seen. It's graphically impressive because of the art style, and like the lighting is really good,
mm-hmm.
but it's not like realistic. So when you look at it, it's hard to say like how much of a powerhouse it is, because the art style is so strong in that game that you can't tell, but looking at the shading, like, it looks very good. And like, that's a Unity powered game. There's a lot of Unity powered stuff. A lot of the stuff coming out on the Wii U, like the eShop stuff, if it's not done by Nintendo, it is probably done with Unity. Even if it's done by Nintendo, it might be done by Unity. I don't know what their development practice is, but I know that the only like supported toolkit now for devving for Wii U is Unity, so I'm assuming they're probably using that in-house.
Yeah, that would make sense.
Otherwise, they have their own game engine that they're using in-house, but that's expensive. Like, the only reason why companies use in-house engines is because they built them and they went, oh man, this was really expensive, we better use this. Like, like EA with Frostbite, like how many hundreds of millions of dollars went into that, so like everyone has to use Frostbite now,
right?
But so yeah, Unity was announced as well with the Oculus support, and a new graphics pipeline that was actually really impressive, and like the tools in the new Unity are really powerful, like audio tools, visual tools, and also level design tools like terrain creators that just ship now like inside of Unity, so that you don't have to like model out your own levels, which is fantastic. Like, but if you're looking in, like, if you're interested in making games, like, even as a hobby, that is a tool to download and mess around with. Follow some tutorials. It's pretty powerful. And then Source 2 was finally announced officially. I guess there was a leak of it last year alongside the Left 4 Dead 3 leak. And so that should be coming out, I think, this year. Maybe it's out. But that's going to be free to content developers, kind of like everyone else, because I think that's kind of the route that you have to go down now, because like traditional engine developers, like you look at Crytek, for example, they're in financial trouble. Unreal, or Epic, I mean, they're not really in financial trouble because they're owned by Take-Two, right? So they're not in a bad position. But if you think about it, who is using Unreal Engine now? Like, no one's using these big engines anymore because everyone's developed an in-house one.
Right.
Like, EA has one, so everyone's using Frostbite. And Ubisoft has one, so everyone's using that one. And, like, there's not a market now to go sell these huge engines. Like, you look at Crytek. What's the last, like, Crytek game? Or, like, CryEngine game that wasn't a Crytek game? Because, like, I guess Crysis was the last Crytek game that I can think of. Oh, and then Rise, which was also made by Crytek. So, like, there's just not a market space for these engines anymore. So going free is probably their only hope, and, like, taking royalties.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised to see Unreal go away soon. At least the engine, because it just doesn't make sense to be around. It's too expensive and big.
Yeah, that's a huge cut when you get to a certain point.
Yeah, I think they still do. I think you can still like negotiate a buyout of the engine if you're a larger developer. But like I said, I don't know any larger developers who are not using in-house engines at this point.
Yeah,
because everyone sunk hundreds of millions into an engine and went, okay, well, we have to use these. We don't have a choice. Yeah. We have to recoup all of this money.
Yeah, make it
even
work.
Even if Unreal is better, we have to use this. All right. So there were a couple other things from GDC. So Offworld is coming back. Do you know what Offworld was?
No, I don't. Enlighten me.
Offworld was a games site, like a gaming news site. They closed down for a while. However, I think they just relaunched on Monday, I believe. They relaunched on the 9th. And now it is a site ran by Alexander Lee. I can't pronounce her last name. L-E-I-G-H. But she wrote for Gamasutra, which is kind of like an industry blog. Or, well, an industry news site. Like, it's for game developers more than gamers, which is why sometimes there's weird backlashes and like the articles are not written to appeal to gamers. And so, for example, she wrote an article like at the peak of Gamergate about how like quote unquote gamers are not necessarily the people that you have to target as your audience as a game developer. And when she was using the term gamers, like she was specifically referring to that group of individuals. Like she was referring to, I guess, the Gamergaters. But people got really upset because she wrote an article saying, like, these are not the people that you have to, like, target as a game developer. You can target whoever you want as a game developer. She kind of lost her job because people freaked out. Intel pulled her advertising because of a write-in campaign by Gamergate about this Gamasutra article. However, she relaunched Offworld during GDC. And Offworld is a site specifically to allow people who are like minorities, basically women and people of color, to write about games. Because if you look at like the game, right, if you look at the game industry like as a whole, including the press, like it's pretty dominated by white males, which I don't think anyone's surprised by. Like if you look at STEM fields in general, that's the case. So the big announcement was that Offworld is relaunching as a place for basically minorities to write about games and issues in games.
Okay.
So far, like Alexander Lee is like probably one of the best writers that there were in games. Not necessarily a popular writer, but she actually can write, like, as the skill of writing, which is something not a lot of people have in video games journalism. Like, they're not good writers. They're just people who like video games, whereas she is actually a good writer who happens to write about video games. So even if you don't necessarily agree with her, like, the writing on that site so far has been quite strong.
That's good.
It's worth looking into. But it's nice to see a site, at least, that hopes to have a different viewpoint than everyone else.
Yeah, we need that.
Yeah, especially since, like, there's a lot of political issues, I guess, in games that people don't really talk about. Not necessarily that they have to be talked about all the time, but to also, like, consider them not to be issues is, I guess, naive.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to see at least some place that can focus in on that as a, like, an idea, because I don't necessarily think, like, that's the content that I want to see IGN tackle.
Probably not.
Yeah. I don't think there's a lot else from GDC. Just a little interesting snippet. Do you know the name, the game No Man's Sky?
No, I do not know No Man's Sky.
It's a space game being developed by Hello Games. They're UK-based. They made Joe Danger.
Okay.
Which was like, it's like a site bike. But No Man's Sky is a, like, space adventure game that's procedurally generated. And the world is so big that the developers had to program these space probes that go out and they take pictures and film things for them so that they can release them in the press, in their press packages, because they couldn't actually go out and find stuff. Like, it's this huge universe, basically, that everything, you can go to everything. Like, you start off on a planet and you go and you build a spaceship, and then you can go fly anywhere in the universe, and you can go to any planet that you can see, and, like, go down to the bottom of any of the oceans, and, like, go anywhere. And it's because it's all procedurally generated, and the goal is that, like, basically people are trying to get to the center of the universe, and then there's some kind of, they haven't really mentioned a lot else other than people go to the center of the universe and there's something there that you want.
Wow. That's next level right there.
But, like, the game looks huge. Like, the graphics are fantastic. I guess there's kind of a lot of hype behind it because the tech seems insane. Like, if the world is so big that you can't actually go through it, they're like, yeah, it's going to take you, like, days and days and days to get to the center of the universe. And it's like, oh, okay then.
Wow.
Like, it seems pretty crazy, but it also seems just as crazy that they built basically virtual drones that fly around this universe and take screenshots.
yeah, that's that is bizarre.
Yeah, I found that to be kind of just interesting little piece of news.
Oh yeah, that is neat.
Yeah, you should look into that game. It's pretty crazy.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Also being developed by, like, a very small team. Like, Hello Games is not a huge developer. I mean, their only other game is like Joe Danger and Joe Danger 2, which are actually, they're pretty great, but, like, they're not huge games. They're like, they're Excitebike in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't, not a lot of other news. That's why we started doing this podcast every 2 weeks rather than every week. Every 2 weeks is too much. You run out of stuff to talk about.
Right.
So I guess let's start wrapping this up, because I don't think there's anything else worth talking about.
Okay.
So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the 81st episode of the Dapper Gaming Podcast. I've been Ryan. Joe was here. He's not anymore. And thank you, Dave, for coming on. Where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on the ReRes channel on YouTube, and you can also find me on my personal channel, youtube.com/nextgamedave is the URL for that.
All right, then. Well, thanks for coming on. And
thanks for having me.
Hopefully we'll see you again.
Sounds good.
All right. Goodbye, everyone.